I love the little soundboard.
Cue up the happy music.
I don't have a button for that.
You don't have a button for that? We need happy music. I know. So we've had so much sad music lately. We got to get some happy music.
All right, I'll find some happy music for the next show.
Welcome to the Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gaybauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. Well, Marlene, we have taken a month off, but we have a number of episodes lined up for the next few weeks. So we are definitely back with a vengeance. And speaking of back with a vengeance, I understand that you have a new consulting firm that you've set up. So first of all, congratulations. And second of all, can you tell me a little bit more about what you're doing?
Sure. Thank you. The name of the company is SparkMind Advisors, LLC. And basically, we're focusing on legal operations, innovation, and knowledge initiatives in the legal industry. So, some projects we could do is help you with your innovation rollouts or give you some feedback on what types of innovation might work in your particular instance. So really looking forward to exploring these opportunities.
Well, it sounds like fun. I know, it's always a challenge to have a startup that you're doing, but I have the ultimate confidence in you. So,
I'm glad somebody does.
Well, I have a feeling at some point I'm going to be reaching out to you for some help. So,
yeah, great.
Well, we've got a packed show today. We've got Jennifer Johnson and Barbara Mallon who are joining us, and we're going to talk a little marketing and culture in law firms. But before we get into that, let's get into this week's information inspirations.
So, Greg, I have a nice little inspiration on access to justice in the UK. So, Deloitte Legal is supporting the charity LawWorks, which is also known as the Solicitors Pro Bono Group, in developing and launching Free Legal Answers UK, which is an online platform that connects individuals in need of legal advice with lawyers who are able to provide it on a pro bono basis. So, this Access to Justice project, which is in an early pilot stage, has helped about 50 clients so far and seen 90 lawyers sign up. It's now looking to attract more lawyers to help put out offerings to their service for free. Now, Free Legal Answers UK is focused on those individuals on a low income, but also those who are not eligible for legal aid. Deloitte Legal also provided management and technical expertise to assess LawWorks in configuring and testing the website to fit the legal environment in England and Wales. Their efforts relate to a wider mission run by Deloitte called 1 Million Futures, which aims to help 1 million people to get where they want to be through access to education and employment, raising aspirations, improving skills, and developing leaders. I like this quote very much from Michael Castle, who's the UK managing partner at Deloitte Legal, and this is the quote he made about the platform. Justice is a fundamental right for everyone. It should not be exclusive for those who can afford it. Well said, Michael. Good stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to see them bring that back over the sea and do something here in the U.S.
Well, apparently the ABA has a similar program.
Okay.
And they reference that in the article.
Okay. Well, Marlene, I'm going to limit myself to one inspiration this week, but it's a good one.
You shared this with me before. It's like, you win, okay?
Right,
I'm just saying,
right.
You win.
But it's also one that, I will address in a very tasteful manner. So
yeah, let's see how well you do with that. Go ahead.
So there was this woman who rented out her house up on in Martha's Vineyard to a company that she later found out filmed some 14 different pornographic films over a 5-month period of time at her home. And so what was interesting was she actually sued the film company for copyright violations because they had included some of her original paintings and other artwork that she had in the house in the film. Now, there's some legal issues here. I think she actually copyrighted the material after the fact, but
she didn't go after him for sort of violating any type of contract in terms of how to use location.
I think later she did, but
out. Good.
So now of course, as I'm reading this, the first question I had was, all right, who told her that her house was in, you know, who was watching?
And did somebody tell her?
Yeah,
did she figure it out herself?
in my head, I'm imagining that, you know, some friend of hers calls her up and said, hey, I was home alone the other day reading the articles on Pornhub. And I happened to see your paintings in the background of this movie I'd been watching for an hour.
So, oops.
So and she had initially, back to your point on the damages, I think she had initially demanded $15,000 in property damage. And once she copyrighted the materials, that the damage claims went up to about $3 million. So, and then the other part that was kind of funny was the judge said, even though one of the attorneys requested, he denied the request that all of the jurors watch all of the films in order to see how much of her artwork showed up in the film. So how was that? Was that tasteful?
That was pretty tasteful. And I would say if the jurors did sit through and watch all the 14 films to look for her artwork, you know, they'd know it if they saw it.
Good one. I see what you did there.
Yeah, I saw. Good, right? And weren't embroidered pillows involved in this too? I think you told me.
I can't remember if there was embroidered pillows or not, but it would not surprise me.
All kinds of artwork. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you win. So my second inspiration is happy or scary, depending on how you feel. I got this from Be Specific, a great curated legal and tech newsletter by Sabrina Pacifici. If you don't subscribe, you should. It's free with requested donations of $5. So I love the introductory quote from Science Magazine. It's a fact of life for birders that some species are fiendishly difficult to tell apart. In particular, the sparrows and drab songbirds dubbed little brown jobs. Distinguishing individuals is nearly impossible. Our podcast has just gone downhill.
You did that tastefully as well.
Yes, I did. And I will continue in that vein. So, a convolutional neural network tool has been developed at the University of Montpellier by Andre Ferreira, a PhD student. The AI tool shifts through thousands of pictures to figure out which visual features can be used to classify a given image. It then uses that information to classify new images. Now, this type of tech has been used to classify plants and animals, including different animals of the same species. So what Andre did here was take multiple pics of the backs of tagged weavers at a feeder. The pictures were fed into a computer, and the system could ID individuals 90% of the time, which is about the same as humans if they can see the front of the bird and their neck rings. So pretty soon, expect to have to ID birds and dogs and other creatures that access our roads to prove you're not a computer. And that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations.
Marlene, we hear a lot about how law firms market their culture both internally and externally. You know, with everything going on in the world today, it's crazy out there. You know, the firm's culture.
It's a zoo.
It's a zoo. the firm's culture is being scrutinized more than ever. And probably for a good reason. So we wanted to bring on a couple of experts to talk about what firms need to do when it comes to how it views and markets its own culture in a time of COVID and the societal demands on anti-racism. We asked Jennifer Johnson and Barbara Mallon to come onto the show and discuss those very issues. Well, as most listeners have heard us say on the show before, never let a crisis go to waste, as there are so many new opportunities for those of us who are ready and willing to adapt to these challenges. You know, another comment that we like to say during tough times is that a crisis doesn't necessarily make you better, so much as it amplifies who you already are. And for those of us in law firms, this means that your skills and your overall structure and your culture of your firm were definitely put to the test here in 2020.
Indeed. We wanted to discuss how firms are handling the combined stress of adjusting to the needs of the market, understanding how to present that message to current and potential clients, all the while understanding how the culture of the firm plays a role in how capable the firm and all its pieces are under these pressures.
And Marlene, like I've done in the past, I used to walk down the hall, but now I have to pick up the phone or instant message people. But I reached out to one of my own at Jackson Walker and asked Barbara Mallon, our Chief Marketing and Business Development Officer, to talk with us about the critical role that marketing and business development teams play within these times of crisis. So Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Greg, it's great to be here and always fun to kick things around with you.
And to discuss the issues surrounding culture, we reached out to Jennifer Johnson, CEO of Calibrate Legal, a legal recruitment company, as well as a prolific voice in the legal marketing world. Jennifer, it's good to talk with you.
I am a subscriber to the podcast, and I'm so excited that you invited me. So thank you.
It's good to have you here. So Barbara, let's start with you. I wanted to start this conversation with you because, you know, I've seen firsthand the amount of responsibility that fell on you and your team when all this began back in February, I think, is when we started really looking at it and making potential plans for how we were going to continue operations if the pandemic took hold throughout the world. So how would you say your marketing and business development operations differ from the first of the year until now?
So, Greg, as you and I both know from our experience when we responded to Hurricane Harvey, we learned at that point that developing a business continuity plan isn't really just an academic exercise. And we were fortunate at Jackson Walker that we had recently updated our business continuity plan just as sort of a normal part of our course of business. And so as we rolled into the COVID timeframe and it became apparent that we were going to have to implement the plan, we had a plan roughly in place and were able to build on that. In the law firm environment, one of the main things that you have to think about in terms of business continuity is obviously how you keep the day-to-day legal operations of business running. And that means really how do you continue to do the legal work without missing a beat? So the specific question that it became my responsibility to focus on is, how can you maintain a culture of client service when all the normal supporting structures that would normally be there to help facilitate that client service have been rendered completely unavailable? We went into 2020 with a really heavy focus on identifying and serving client needs and doing that through collaboration. And in a way, that was really fortuitous for us. We were about to be in a situation where client needs became really even more urgent and the requirement to collaborate became really non-negotiable. So we were facing a situation where we had a plan that we had developed for how to implement that client focus, but we needed to completely reframe it nonetheless in the new remote environment. So ultimately, at a really kind of basic level, we faced two questions as, you know, we transitioned from what we thought 2020 would look like and what 2020 ultimately did look like. And the first was, how can you focus on client needs when you can't meet the clients face to face? And clients also are really fully occupied with really pressing work matters because their world has just changed. And then the second thing is, how can you sustain a culture of collaboration without those sort of random collisions that happen when you meet in the office together?
Yeah, I know that you and I rely a lot on our relationships throughout the industry and bounce ideas off of our peers out there to help us handle these novel situations. And I think 2020 is probably the most novel situation we could think of. I know we talked about your involvement with the Legal Marketing Association, and you've been working with the professional advocacy group within LMA. You know, it seems like the timing was pretty fortunate for that. So what are you doing to help support each other during these crazy times?
Well, you know, as you note, you and I both have pretty healthy networks of peers that we bounce ideas off of. And for me, just having those networks has been a really immensely valuable resource to begin with, because there really is no other thing like the ability to walk down the hall or to pick up the phone or start a Zoom call with somebody who knows exactly the challenges that you're facing. Every legal marketer, of course, knows the value of the relationships they form in the LMA, and the professional advocacy group was a really important resource in this time because what the professional advocacy group is setting out to do is to try to provide firms with insight into the scope of the capabilities of their legal marketing professionals and how the teams that they have can help their firms understand client needs and adapt to new and changing client needs. And it's doing this real world work that helps legal marketers learn how to drive response and to meet client needs and to deal with the economic shocks that have arisen as a result of COVID-19 and to drive, you know, diversity, inclusion, equity, and equality, the other, you know, pressing issue that's arisen during this time frame.
Jennifer, you recently wrote a great Law 360 piece along with Kathleen Pearson, the chief HR officer at Pillsbury, where you discuss steps that law firms could take to actually improve their culture. Of course, culture isn't just feeling the effects of COVID. It's also feeling a huge societal change around anti-racism. That may be a 1-2 punch in which some firms may have had a hard time adjusting. What do you think firms should look at when it comes to culture today?
Well, it's a big question, and you're asking me what I think, and so here's what I think. I think that law firms need to have a hard look in the mirror. I think that they need to do some serious assessment of their cultures. A lot of firms focus their culture only on the lawyers. And it is my wholehearted belief that in order to have a thriving law firm of the future, we need to look at the talent on the whole. Every person who works within the law firm walls needs to be included in all of the initiatives that are happening across the firm. I think there's an incredible disservice, an incredible inequity going on. We already have an environment that's sort of caste system-ish, right? The haves, the have-nots, and even within the haves, there's that hierarchy. But I think for future firms to survive and thrive, which don't need to be mutually exclusive, but I think they could, you've got to really break down the silos and think about what is it, why do people work, and meet them there, right? And start providing an environment that people want to contribute to, all of the people. And I just think we are doing a major disservice to the law firm ecosystem by not including everybody in these diversity challenges. I mean, the business services people in law firms, if you didn't have them, you're out of business.
Yeah.
They matter. They play an important and vital role in law firm sustainability. And so I think that you asked me what they need to look at. I think that they need to talk to everybody and get a sampling of their workforce and understand who they are as a whole. I also think that they might benefit by flipping the questions. So flipping it. How do we comply with the regulations surrounding FMLA? Instead of asking those questions, what if we said, how do we create an environment in which we have parents with primary parenting responsibility thrive in our culture? So what if we flip it from being policy or regulation based on our policies and more about like playing into what we want to see in terms of behaviors and the kinds of people that you want to attract?
Just out of curiosity, you talked about having a caste system on this. I know firms rely heavily upon, you know, there's the attorneys and then there's the support staff. Do you see firms having to cross over that, or do you see doing the same message to two different groups?
If they don't, they're going to have their workforce vote with their feet. I think that especially when we go back into the four walls, at some point, it's going to be noticeable. I mean, if you look at these, every law firm, go just pick one. Most of them talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and very few of them have anything that has anything to say about anything other than the lawyers. And at some point, your workforce is going to notice that, from the mailroom to your marketing teams to your billing teams, people are going to notice that. And they're going to say, hey, now, maybe they don't value me. Maybe they don't appreciate me. Maybe they don't believe in me. And they're going to move along to a place that does. And I think that's going to happen sooner than later.
All right. I wanted to ask you a really difficult question right up front here. So if you were to ask 50 different people within a law firm, they could be baby boomers, they could be Gen Z, they could be attorneys, they could be staff. So if you were to ask them to define what that firm's culture is, how many different answers are you going to get out of those 50? And really, is it a bad thing if it's different answers?
The winning answer, Greg, for $1 million is 50 at least, depending on the day. And so I've talked about this all the time with people who have had the opportunity to listen to me opine, and I don't know if they liked it or not, but I made them listen. And that's the thing. So if you look at talent within a law firm, generally speaking, there's the legal talent folks, and then there's the HR, which is everything else, right? And they're not usually under the same umbrella. Most often, they're not. So there's the legal recruiting and PD folks, and then there's the HR folks. Inherently, it's different. And the message that the folks that go through the business services recruiting side is very different than, not even the message, but the process, the paperwork they fill out, the level of responsiveness, like every person that applies for a job with your firm is receiving you and your brand. And so you could have, even within the lawyers, I mean, associates, let's start with law students, then your summer associates, the ones you rejected, the ones you gave an offer to, then you've got the associates, the ones who, you know, are on the track to all the wonderful things, and then the one who maybe had a baby, or the one who decided to go in-house. Well, what was their story? Then you've got lateral associates, lateral partners. You've got alumni. What do they say? I mean, that's just on the lawyer side. So I would say that it's completely conflicting. I do understand that you have to have a different recruitment strategy and different compensation discussions based on the level of years of experience and positioning in the firm. I get all of that. I just don't think you're going to find any threads of similarity through anything, and there should be.
Okay, so it's not a bad thing then to have.
The first firm who figures it out is going to be called innovation in my book.
Well, you know, and the reason I ask that is because, like, if anyone has gone through a rebranding period, one of the things that you hear a lot from consultants is you don't define your brand. Your clients are the ones who define your brand. And I'm just wondering if it's a similar thing with culture, because you constantly hear the leadership talk about culture, but I'm not sure that it's really the leadership may have an idea of what they want the culture to be, but the actual culture is actually, I think, is interpreted by everyone, you know, from the mailroom up.
There, I believe that there is a gross misalignment between the perceived culture in most law firms and what the reality of the situation is. And that's even within the lawyer ranks. I feel like there's such a divide between, you know, very senior partners and everybody else, right? So I would say probably your more junior lawyers are having a more similar experience to the reality of the culture as maybe a marketing or a business development manager would experience. But there's this layer at the top that feeds one another, and it's the same. It's this bathwater drinking, right? Drinking our own bathwater. We're the best. We're the brightest. And that infusion of reality doesn't occur as often as it should be. And if you look at companies who are notorious for culture in a good way, they're regularly evaluating, they're regularly pulse surveying to make sure that what they're saying is actually true.
So this is all really fascinating, talking about culture but can a firm really change its culture, Jennifer?
100%, if it wants to. But it has to have the right environmental factors in place. It has to have the right people that believe that something needs to change. So there's things that must be true, and for in order for it to happen, it can happen, and it's a journey. It doesn't happen overnight, and it's not something that you can just expect will show up and be apparent. There's change management, which is an incredible discipline that must be exercised in order for a cultural shift to happen. So yes, yes, and.
Hey, we had a whole show on yes, and.
That's true. We did.
It is the best parenting technique I've ever learned. Yes, and.
And what about, like, you have to have everybody on board, right? I mean, it can't just be, you know, people at the top, or it can't just be sort of people, you know, in the workforce. I mean, everybody has to kind of believe in this together. And isn't that a challenge in firms where, you know, it's kind of a group of individuals working on their own businesses, as opposed to sort of a corporation, which, you know, all kind of have the same goal, arguably?
I think that different firms, you know, see the world differently. And there are certainly some that are firm first in mentality. And those will probably be the ones that will shift easier, faster, quicker in terms of a pivot, because it does have strong leadership and everybody believes in the firm and the leadership and you fall in line. And then there's some that do operate as individual sole proprietors, you know, sharing healthcare benefits and office space. And so that will be much harder, of course. But I do think that with the right leader, it has to start with the leadership, and then the appropriate change management techniques have to go into play, where you bring people into the conversation. And honestly, if everybody isn't on board, that's okay. They don't have to keep working there. You know, they can move on to a place that maybe does feel more comfortable to them culturally.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, what's marketing's role in helping show the world the firm's culture and how that culture affects the way the firm does business as well as interacts with clients and the community as a whole?
Well, I mean, as Jennifer points out, you know, the first challenge is distilling what the culture actually is, because if you ask 50 different people, you're likely to get 50 different answers. But it's important to distill at least the essence of, you know, what the firm is trying to convey as its culture, because it's part of the brand. And brand is, of course, what you want to market. Ultimately, a lot of client satisfaction is going to come down to whether there's a good cultural fit between the lawyers that they're working with and the client representative and the client company as a whole. Because really, at a fundamental level, competence is now these days table stakes in our industry. And so in most cases, your client satisfaction is not going to be driven by whether or not the firm is able to do the work, but rather whether the lawyer and the client can work together smoothly for cultural reasons. So a good legal marketing team is going to be able to help lawyers really effectively sit down with the clients and assess what the client's needs are. And then it's going to be able to take those needs and showcase ways that differentiate the firm. And whether that's going to be the geography that the firm is in, the depth of experience that the firm has in the area, the fee structure, the service commitment that the firm brings to the table, all of those are things that are aspects of the cultural experience with the firm that can help drive that cultural fit between law firm clients and the firm itself. And by highlighting sort of the basic ethos of the firm and what the firm values, how those values drive what they provide to the clients as value, and what characteristics turn that ethos into value for the client, all will go into what the legal marketing team builds out as sort of the pitch to the client in terms of the importance of, you know, the firm's culture in terms of the engagement.
Well, Jennifer, when I was reading your article, you know, you list out 6 points that you talk about culture. And the last of the 6 points is that a law firm should hire for culture fit. Now, one little side note, I did a few weeks ago, I sent out a tweet and I said, well, what's a word that law firms use that may have a a cultural bias to it that they don't realize. And the immediate answer I got back, and I think it was from Jordan Furlong, was fit. Fit can be used in order to only bring in people that look and act and have business like we already have, which, you know, on the surface may be perfectly innocent, but cumulatively can have an impact. So if firms are really looking to improve their overall culture, what are some of the guidelines that they should follow when they are looking to attract new talent who will enhance the improved culture goal?
Well, I would say you got to go to the first five steps before you're ready to start hiring people to fit the culture.
Can't just go to six?
No, you can't. Fast forward, unfortunately. But honestly, I think a lot of people miss some of the pieces. And this, again, it's a journey. It's not something that can be solved now, but it's time to start now so you'll be ready. I would say the first is you got to figure out what that culture is. There's so many schools of thought and methodologies for how you could begin attacking this topic. One of my favorites is actually a book called Primed to Perform: How to Build the Highest Performing Cultures Through the Science of Total Motivation. And they call it TOMO. So it's the TOMO score. But one of the things that
believe... who wrote that book?
Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely. Sorry. Lindsay McGregor and Neil Doshi. And there's a couple of TED Talks that you can look at. And I actually have this wonderful book called The Culture Book. It's recently published, but it's a bunch of different culture stewards talking about different, like Netflix is in here, Accenture is in here, DLA Piper is actually in here. DLA Piper is quoted in here as using this TOMO factor within their some of their initiatives. But essentially, it's really looking at why do people go to work? Those that are driven by purpose, play, and potential. So purpose is, I believe that doing this work is good for the world. Play is, I love it. I'm excited by it. I can't wait to go see what I can do next. And potential is like, I'm doing this to get someplace in my career, right? And that's, you want as much of that as possible. What you want less of are people who are motivated to work because of economic pressure, emotional pressure, or inertia. So an economic pressure is the obvious. I got to work to pay the bills. Emotional pressure is I got to show up and do this or else my boss will throw me under the bus or make me look silly. And then inertia is if somebody asks you, why do you do this job? You're like, I really have no idea why I work here. You just do this. It's like you go every day. And so obviously you want to attract more people with purpose, play, and potential than you do with economic or emotional pressure or inertia, right? And so if you can figure out what motivates your people, all of the people, not just the lawyers, what motivates all of the people to work, then it will directly correlate with how well they work. And so it's layered, right? This is, there you have a book for a reason because it's incredibly detailed. But essentially, if you design a workplace where people have this high TOMO factor, then you will have a higher customer experience as a result. And so they have, again, in these TED Talks, you can look at it, but they did it where it was like, okay, which airline do you think has the highest TOMO? And everybody said Southwest, which right. has the lowest, and United. And sure enough, when she popped it up, it was that. And then, you know, so it's really, really an interesting concept. And I would encourage anybody to check it out, but that it has to start with unpacking it and looking holistically. This narrow focus of what works for the lawyers is going to backfire sooner than later.
It's really interesting. And it's, you know, it's a different way of looking at culture than I think I've sort of heard in firms before. I mean, it's the categories are, I think, looser. And you know, I think that that's a good thing because a lot of different types of things can fit into those and still work.
Well, and you've got to think about what is your goal and your purpose and then hiring for that as opposed to setting up these parameters. Again, it's like flipping the question. What are we looking to be and how do we attract that as opposed to putting barriers in place to make sure that people that we don't want stay away? And you asked the question about, you know, hiring. You want to eliminate bias? How about with manager level and positions in a marketing department, for example, you get rid of a college diploma being a thing. What if we got rid of that in some instances, right? Where years of experience as a graphic designer and a really sharp brain and proven track record of coming to work and contributing, you can be a manager. But in most law firms, you can't if you don't have a college degree. And we know that the socioeconomic breakdown, it's very difficult for certain folks in our country to get a college degree, to go to college. So by making college degrees a thing, we're eliminating the potential for our companies.
And I can imagine it's more than just the college degree. That's an easy one to point at.
That's an easy one, yes.
Well, and as you were talking through that, it just reminded me that, you know, a lot of times we look for someone that can work 80 hours a week, that can bring in the business. But in the three P's that you listed there, I didn't hear 80 hours a week. This is the only thing that drives them. And so, you know, and one of the things, and I think law firms are finally catching on to this, is that if you really do want a diverse workforce, you've got to meet them where they are and not expect them to meet you where you are. So,
yeah, I mean, when we can undo hours billed tied directly to compensation, that would be a really nice step in the right direction, because there's a lot of people who can contribute in lots of ways on a team, on a billable team, who might not be able to bill as many hours. Barbara, I was going to tell you, as you were talking about that, the CMOs and culture, I actually wrote a piece 2 years ago called The Culture Stewards of Tomorrow's Law Firm. And I asserted it should be the CMOs. Yeah. Obviously, there's a place for talent in all of the pieces, but it's, if you're going to be the one putting the message out into the world on the website about who we are and what our value proposition is, seems like a good place for culture to live, because you've got to, you can't, marketing people, we know to be true, right, Barbara? They don't do well when they don't believe in whatever it is that they're marketing, right? And they have to believe in it. And what better place for culture to live than in the place that has to sell the culture?
Well, and marketing teams are also really good at uncovering, you know, messages and, you know, implicit messages and, you know, the messages that are kind of beneath the surface and that deserve to be surfaced.
And we have to create safe environments for those to them to be able to raise those and for it to be heard, as many of them are frankly issues, right? Like, so we hear it and we will do something about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm really interested about this idea of how we value different contributions. If we sort of take away the whole, you know, it's only based on billable, because I mean, that's kind of an artificial construct, right? It's like, that's what we have to base it on. But in other environments and in the world in general, that's not how we do things. So maybe we could look at some other models in terms of how, you know, how different contributions are valued and be able to model off of something like that. I mean, are there any things out there that might be, you know, you guys think might be good?
I mean, the big four have got, I mean, they're the closest thing we've got to our model in terms of that partnership structure. And so many of them are doing really great work in talent analytics for their own workforce, in addition to consulting to their clients. Accenture is doing some really amazing things for their talent and their workforce. But it's interesting, I would say that on this journey, again, we can't forget about the business services pros, right? So they get bonuses, and it's typically based on somebody's opinion and based on how I feel that day, right? It's completely subjective. As opposed to when we bring people from outside the industry in, they ask, what am I going to be measured against? How will I get my bonus? And that's something we're going to have to do as we start looking at truly embracing all of the talent. We're going to have to put some stuff in place, some infrastructure in place for a career path for a revenue enabler, is what we call them, all the revenue generators and revenue enablers. There's got to be career pathing going in. We've got to set. So it's not the zoo animals making the decisions, right? The hippos, the highest paid person's opinion, or the zebras, right? The zero expertise, but really adamant. So we've got to get it away from opinions and emotions making decisions on the business services side, and based in data and facts.
I like both hippos and zebras.
And I'm not sure how I'm feeling about being an enabler. So I'm just going to move on to the next. So I'm not going to move on to the next question. Barbara, what do you see as permanent changes to how firms are going to engage in business development coming out of the adjustments to COVID, anti-racism, and just a general shift in how the world's going to look post-2020?
Right. So first, the things I think are probably going away or going away at least to some degree. I don't think that we're going to continue to see large chunks of budget devoted to suites and professional sporting venues. I don't see 300-person seminars being a thing that is going to be continuing at least on an in-person basis anytime in the near future. I don't see these gold-plated sponsorships that, you know, apparently are critical to making our clients like us being a high priority in budgets going forward. Many firms have cut those things either, you know, sharply or completely from their budget and have seen this year in 2020 that their business has not suffered as a result of not having those sorts of spends allocated in their budget. What I do see continuing is the need to develop authentic relationships, authentic connections to clients, and authentic connections within people's firms, because business development success these days really lies in the ability to collaborate across boundaries. And that's across boundaries in the firm, not just with other lawyers in the firm, but also with the business professionals in the firm. And the ability to collaborate with clients is also critical to the success of any lawyer in terms of business development. And I think we're going to see a trend of needing to be able to collaborate productively with other law firms, even. It's a trend that's coming, and it's one that we need to be ready for. And it's only in those ways that you can be prepared to take on the truly complex legal work. Any person who's not collaborating can do the simple stuff, but when you're dealing with complex and uncertain and volatile needs, you really have to have a team that has expertise beyond your own. So the question then becomes, how do you build that culture of collaboration, the culture that people want to be a part of? And that doesn't necessarily sound like a business development kind of question, but it's a question that my team and I have actually been spending quite a lot of time thinking about, especially as we confront the need to build that sort of culture in an environment that may be remote for some time, or that may transition to a more work from home kind of environment for people at all levels within the organization. And so you have to think about things like how you transmit the culture of your firm in a world that doesn't look like the one that the more senior lawyers in our firm have grown up in, where everything from learning how to draft a pleading to learning how to snag a client were things that you learned at the side of a senior lawyer through sort of informal channels. I think that kind of one of the things that it's an interesting parallel to think about is some of the thought leadership that Richard Susskind has around whether courts are places or services. I think we have to ask the same sort of question about whether law firms are places or collections of people and services. And so we have to wonder whether the primary benefit of the firms that we, you know, drive down to downtown to and park in the parking garage at is the services and amenities that they provide, or whether it's the relationships that we cultivate there. And so some firms, you know, are really just hotels for lawyers, and there's not much bigger going on there. But those aren't the firms that are going to be successful as we enter into this new era. It's going to be the world where there's something bigger, where we're looking for synergy that goes beyond just sort of, you know, the creative success. And that's a cultural challenge that I think is really worthwhile for a legal marketing team to sink its teeth into.
I want, if I might, I just wanted to follow up with that on that last question. Same question, but two different groups. So I was wondering if we can expand a little bit upon the firms sort of working together on business development and or, you know, doing the actual business. And also, Barbara, you were talking a little bit about sort of a volatile situation. So what about, you know, outside expertise in terms of, you know, helping a firm, you know, sort of figure out in terms of, you know, where they should be developing business, you know, either through use of analytics or, you know, or other or methodologies?
I think that there is unquestionably a place for analytics in our world that is much more significant than we are even, you know, thinking about these days. Law firms are these vast repositories of data, much of which we don't really know what to do with. And, you know, there's, you know, a world out there that can assist us with that. And there are people also within our own firms that can help dig into the data. And you know, the question is, you know, does that expertise lie in the ranks of lawyers? Generally not. That expertise lies elsewhere. And in order to harness that, lawyers need to be willing to look around and value the contributions that other people can make, either to, you know, analysis of their cases or just analysis of, you know, how to procure new business.
I guess my initial reaction to the question was, you know, there's a group, there's so many of these law firm alliances out there that many, many, many firms are a part of. And it's interesting, I've spoken at a few of them. I think that there's real opportunity for firms that are in those law firm alliances to kind of more closely curate business with one another. I think that they tend to be seen as a referral. I hope they refer me, like they have to, because I'm in the city that that client might need something in, as opposed to really leveraging or they're exploiting. Like that's what we're here for, and using it more strategically. I feel like that's a low hanging fruit for anybody that's a member of one of those law firm alliances.
That's definitely part of sort of that trend of collaborating across law firm boundaries that I see. You know, definitely taking advantage of collaborative capabilities and alliances where you aren't even necessarily stepping on each other's toes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole other world of collaborating with people that you legitimately see as competitors. And I think that that's another area where, you know, we're going to see some real changes and a real need of law firms to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, we're already starting to see it with some of the big four in law firms, you know, working on projects together.
Well, Jennifer Johnson and Barbara Mallon, I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk with us. This has been fun.
It's been great being here, Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you both. So, Greg, I told you it was a zoo out there. Hippos and zebras.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I felt it when you threw that softball up there at the beginning of the interview. Yeah. The
just ripping off of you, friend. That's all.
The hippos and zebras are out there. Again, thanks to Jennifer and Barbara for coming on. I felt like this is a good conversation to have right now because so many firms are trying to evaluate where their culture is. There's so many layers to this. And I thought Jennifer really did a good job of talking about the different layers that are there. And Barbara jumped in and talked about how firms are attempting to use that in their marketing, both internally and externally.
Yeah, I mean, we were all saying after the recording was over that we really could have done a much deeper dive if we had had more time. So I really hope that people listen to this and that it sparks, you know, further conversation, you know, within departments and firms or, you know, on social media, because there seem to be a lot of not completely answered questions about what culture is and sort of the role it plays and then how you present it and, you know, how you get buy-in about that. And then also about like, what are some of these new types of business development that you know we're going to see. I mean, you know, we just, you know, we touched on it, but I think there's a lot of opportunities for some, you know, further rich discussion about it.
Sounds like a good topic for a webinar that could be sponsored by SparkMind Advisors LLC.
Sure. Absolutely.
So once again, thanks to Jennifer Johnson and Barbara Mallon for joining us today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Before we go, we want to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Rate and review us as well. If you have comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach us on Twitter at GayBauerM or at Glambert, or you can call the Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7270 or email us at geekandreviewpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk to you later.
All right, ciao for now.
Devil's backbone ball. At the devil's backbone.